Morning, Mr. Weidenhammer.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Brad Weidenhammer. I represent Tommy Christopher Cox, who is appealing his conviction under 18 U.S.C. Section 2423A for knowingly transporting a minor in interstate commerce with the intent that the minor engage in prostitution, and Section 2422A for enticing an individual to travel in interstate commerce to engage in prostitution. Before I begin, let me mention one procedural matter. I learned only yesterday that Mr. Cox had filed a pro se motion in this case to supplement his brief.
It was denied.
I understand that, Your Honor. But in his motion, Mr. Cox raised the issue that he no longer believes that I represent his interests in this matter. And so you may be aware that I filed an emergency motion yesterday in response after I was unable to contact Mr. Cox at his prison to assess the situation and determine whether a conflict of interest exists between myself and Mr. Cox, because he did suggest in his motion that I no longer represent his interests in the matter and that he expressed some doubt about my representation. Now, I understand that the court denied that motion yesterday, and so I'm prepared to proceed with arguments under that caveat if the court would like.
Seems appropriate if you proceed, and
yes,
then we can believe is necessary.
Yeah,
later.
I'm not sure that any of us have seen your response. I certainly have not.
No.
Have you seen?
No.
No. But why don't you carry on?
Just for your information then, though, Your Honors, the motion was very short. I simply acknowledged that the potential for a conflict had arisen very recently, and that although I have respect for the scheduling order, I felt as if it was important to resolve the situation before continuing with argument. So with that in mind, I'll proceed. This appeal raises two questions. First, whether Section 2423A requires proof that the defendant knew the victim was a minor when he was transporting him. And secondly, whether the district court erred by admitting substantial evidence regarding the defendant's credit card fraud. I'd like to begin with the evidentiary issue. Mr. Cox was on trial for a narrowly defined crime, the transportation and enticement of Mr. Champion from Chicago to Atlanta on June 21, 2006. Despite the narrow nature of the crime with which he was charged, the government introduced substantial evidence that the defendant had committed credit card fraud, which were charges to which Mr. Cox had already pled guilty. Now, under Rule 404B, evidence of other bad acts is not admissible to prove propensity. But the government filed a motion in limine in the case and argued that this evidence was inextricably intertwined with the charged conduct.
Well, the government presented evidence that Mr. Cox left the state to escape the consequences of his extensive fraud here, and he was trying to conduct his business in another state. That seems to give him a motive to entice one of his best workers to leave Illinois and follow him to Atlanta. Why is that not enough to allow in the credit card fraud? I mean, it explains why Mr. Cox left the state and then tried to get, you know, Mr. Champion to follow him.
Well, Your Honor, that was not an issue that the government argued at any point in the trial. In fact, the government brought all this evidence in through testimony both from Mr. Smith and Mr. Garrett, as well as the two law enforcement officers, Officer Pambuco and Special Agent Sams of the Secret Service. Now, in its motion in limine, indeed, it did make arguments such as motive and concealment and some other arguments about relevance of this evidence. But, in fact, when it came down to trial, the government made no effort to link the fraud evidence with any other aspect of the charged conduct.
I thought the government's theory of linkage really was that the credit card evidence was all part of the story that he was engaged in a prostitution business where Mr. Champion's one of the workers, and it was necessary to show exactly how did he run that business and where did Mr. Champion fit into it. They weren't just friends, for example, as Mr. Cox's lawyer seems to have argued before.
Your Honor, the issue there, I suppose, is that Mr. Cox was not charged with running a prostitution ring, and he wasn't charged with throwing sex parties at hotels, And he certainly wasn't charged, one of the issues at trial was not his credit card fraud.
But he was charged with using Mr. Champion as a prostitute. So even that requires some reason to think that that's what Mr. Champion's doing, not any other thing he might have been doing.
Well, I'll concede, Your Honor, that as the government points out, there is some tangential relevance if you say that Mr. Cox used the credit cards to pay for hotel rooms, allegedly, and that makes it more likely that he actually held these parties, and that makes it more likely in turn.
Right, so on and on down the line.
But my contention on that point would be that the chain of evidence, the linkage of inferences, is so long at that point that the probative value of that evidence is really minuscule. And when we're dealing with propensity evidence, especially really prejudicial propensity evidence like this, marginal or ordinary relevance is simply not sufficient to overcome the hurdle. And that's the Burkos case that we cite in our brief. And truly, when you look at the chain of inferences necessary to say that this is relevant to prove the transportation and enticement, it's an extremely long chain. And even the government, I think, would concede that. So what the government falls back on in their response brief is the issue of concealment, that this was evidence that Mr. Cox had tried to conceal his transportation and enticement. But as you'll notice, what the government doesn't say, actually, is just that. They say it was evidence that he concealed his prostitution, his sex parties, all the things that he was alleged to have done in Chicago. But there's never an allegation that he actually used this credit card fraud to conceal the transportation or enticement, which is the charged conduct.
Well, the defendant argued that he didn't have the means to be a pimp. So why was the credit card fraud not relevant to rebut that argument? I understand your argument that the government may not have tied this together for the jury, but, of course, the government is not obliged to make its best arguments. I mean, the government can assume that the jury will make the connection.
Your Honor, there are 2 points. First, I would say, again, I think the chain of inferences necessary to link the two, even under Your Honor's theory, is remote. And it's a long chain that provides only marginal relevance. But even conceding that Your Honor may have a different view, I would say that the notion that he needed the credit card fraud to fund his prostitution ring, which is what the government has said over and over in this case, is contrary to the evidence in the case. The evidence suggests that he made, if you believe the witnesses, he made immense amount of money with this prostitution ring. Why then would he need credit card fraud to fund his operation? Under the government's own theory,
he's just greedy, as some people are.
That may well be the case, but in that case, his incidental and coincidental greed is not evidence, relevant evidence in this case to prove the charged conduct. I really don't think that the funded his operation theory holds water for that reason. Now, if I could move on, Your Honors, to just discuss briefly the issue of prejudice in this case. The government has argued that this was harmless error, if error at all. And I think if you look at the sort of evidence that the government put forward in this case, it was entirely reliant upon testimony from individuals who admitted that they were participants in or hangers-on to a prostitution ring. And so clearly, the jury would have been entitled to and likely would have questioned their credibility. And in a case where credibility is really the paramount concern, the fact that the government brought in these two law enforcement officials to testify at length about the scope and breadth of this credit card fraud, and again, with no effort to link it to the charged conduct, the danger that would sway the jury against Mr. Cox is great, and I think it raises a probability that they were substantially influenced in issuing their verdict. And as well, the final point on that is that the government itself went to great lengths to introduce this testimony before the jury. They filed a motion in limine. They brought these two officers away from their duties to come into court to testify about these very matters and none other. And so the government, obviously, in its own assessment during trial, thought that this was important evidence to present and that it would influence the jury. And so they can't walk away from that contention quite so easily at the appellate level. Now, unless the court has any other questions, I'd move on to the second issue,
regarding your last point,
yes.
isn't that always going to be the case with other acts evidence that there will be a motion in limine necessarily and some witness is going to have to be brought to court to testify?
Your Honor, I agree that in most cases it would, although in some cases this sort of evidence comes out somewhat spontaneously from witnesses in open court, and that's a different situation. But even if you compare the magnitude of the bad acts evidence that was presented here, where there were 4 witnesses that testified about it, 2 of whom exclusively testified at length about only this issue and not the actual charged conduct, I think that's when sort of the government's effort and, you know, really putting this as a large part of their case comes to show prejudice. Now, the second issue on appeal concerns the knowledge requirement of Section 2423A, which makes it a crime to knowingly transport an individual who has not attained the age of 18 years in interstate commerce with the intent that that individual engage in prostitution. Now, my time is running short, so I'll cut straight to the chase. I think the main problem with the five other circuits which have considered this issue and have come out the other way is that none of them have really reckoned with the redundancy argument, which I set forth in the brief, which is that the statute already contains an intent provision which requires you to form the specific intent to transport this individual from point A to point B, so with the intent that the individual engage in prostitution. Now, clearly it's impossible to do that without first knowing, necessarily, as a part of that intent, knowing that you're transporting an individual. I see that the red light has me, so thank you.
Mr. Madden, good morning.
May it please the Court, Matthew Madden on behalf of the United States. One of the elements, starting first with the issue of the credit card evidence, one of the elements that the government had to prove on both of the prostitution-related counts was intent to prostitute with respect to the minor victim. What better way to prove intent to prostitute than prostitution itself? That's why these hotel parties in Chicago were crucial. The government, those hotel parties, the fact that the defendant hosted these prostitution parties in Chicago made it more likely intended to show that he had the same intention when he transported the minor victim from Chicago to Atlanta. So this wasn't other acts evidence. It was evidence of the crime itself. And the defendant takes an overly narrow view of what the government had to prove in this case in his reply brief and before this court. As a result, it was not an abuse of discretion for the court to rule that this was admissible under the inextricably intertwined doctrine. In addition, this is one of those instances where the court doesn't even need to reach the issue of whether or not the ruling was erroneous, because any potential error here was clearly harmless. First, there was substantial evidence of guilt in this case, and it was largely uncontradicted. There was testimony from three witnesses, including the minor victim and two other witnesses who had been at these parties, that the defendant pimped out the minor victim both in Chicago and in Atlanta. There was also testimony from the minor victim and from Lamar Garrett, who was a friend of the defendant's who went to these parties, that the defendant returned from Atlanta to Chicago and sought out the minor victim and convinced him to go back to Atlanta with him to be a prostitute.
So, Mr. Madden, if that's true, and you know, I know that those things are in the record, why did the government invite this issue on appeal by harping so much on the prostitution parties? So much evidence where, you know, if you've got the minor victim testifying about exactly what happened and these various other people, what other than just inflaming the jury were you trying to do?
Well, I think, you know, the government didn't know exactly how all the evidence was going to come in, and it wanted to prove its case the best it could, and so it called on all of the evidence that it had, and then it, you know, during the closing argument, it narrowed down the evidence. And one point that I like to make with respect to that and with respect to points made in the reply brief is that in the closing argument, although this credit card evidence came in, the closing argument and the rebuttal combined cover 36 pages of transcript. In the closing argument, there's only three references in that 36 pages to the credit card evidence. In the government's closing argument, which is 20 pages, there's not a single reference to the credit card evidence. And then there's only three in that rebuttal. And so the government really didn't draw, even though the evidence came in through the witnesses, the government did not draw attention to it. And that really undermines the defendant's prejudice argument on this issue. Unless the court has any other questions on this issue, I'll move on to the other issue that the defendant addressed. The most natural and grammatical reading of Section 2423A is that the knowingly mens rea requirement applies to transports and not to the age of the victim.
Can you describe for me what it would be to transport somebody unknowingly?
One example.
Negligently was my question.
Well, one example would be if, let's say the defendant was having one of these parties across in northwest Indiana, and he had a large van and a number of, say he had a number of minors in the back that he intended to prostitute out. He stops at a gas station before he crosses the state line, and someone else gets into the car without his knowledge. Then he continues on. Then in that situation, he would not have knowledge that he's transporting at least that individual, I guess, a stowaway.
So. All right, the stowaway example.
Okay.
Any others other than stowaways?
That's the only one that has come to mind.
I mean, it really seems like one of those situations that by the time you're transporting someone, you know that you're transporting them. I understand the rest of the grammatical arguments about direct objects and restrictive clauses.
Right. But I guess on the redundancy argument, which is really the thrust of the reply brief, and I think mm-hmm. what you're getting at, Your Honor, the reason Congress's use of the term knowingly there makes explicit what would be implicit if knowingly was not present. And really the crux of the defendant's argument here is that you can't transport someone in commerce with intent to prostitute that person unless you know that you're transporting them. So he's saying it's already the knowledge requirement with respect to the transportation of the individual is already implicit.
Well, that's right. I mean, he sees knowingly and then as though there were implicit brackets around the rest of the phrase, transporting an individual under the age of 18, interstate commerce, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
All of that's
right.
Inside the imaginary brackets is what he sees knowingly as modifying.
Correct. But the reason Congress inserts that there is why leave that implicit when it could be explicit and clear by inserting the word knowingly in there, which
That's
is very
because Congress always drafts clear statutes, right?
Well, so they add that to make it clear and explicit that there's a knowledge requirement with respect to the transportation of the individual. And another very important point on this redundancy argument is the Mann Act, because the Mann Act completely undermines the argument that Congress could not have intended this type of redundancy. Because the Mann Act, which is at 18 U.S.C. 2421, is virtually identical, except that the age of the victim is not an element of the offense.
You know, I was thinking, you know, about how does the statute discourage the transport of minors if a defendant doesn't know the victim is a minor. I mean, I understand wanting to place the burden of that error on the defendant, but in some cases, there really are kids who clearly look like adults. You know, we had a 14-year-old driving a squad car in Chicago last month and showing up for the morning call at the police station with all the other police officers in the line.
Your Honor, I think that the deterrent effect is that because you've got an enhanced penalty here, the defendant has a very strong incentive to inquire as to figure out how old the people is that he's dealing with, and to stay away stay away from younger looking people.
Unlike the police department.
The other subsections of the statute, the B and C subsections that criminalize travel with intent to engage in illicit sexual conduct, or engaging in illicit sexual conduct in foreign places, the definition of illicit conduct as an age requirement, the victim has to be under 18, and there's an affirmative defense that makes mistake as to the victim's age, reasonable mistake as to the victim's age, an affirmative defense based on perhaps misrepresentation by the victim, etc. Does that have any import for the construction or interpretation of subsection A, which is what's at issue here?
You know, I don't think it does, Your Honor. I don't see how that impacts our analysis.
Well, the reason I ask is because most state statutes and federal statutes that criminalize sex crimes against children do not contain a knowledge requirement as to the age of the victim, and either provide explicitly or have been interpreted by the courts as to not countenance a defense of mistake as to
Correct.
The victim's age. That's the norm.
Correct.
And I guess the absence of that applying to subsection A. Okay, grant
yes,
the lifeline.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. Unless the court has any other questions, we would ask that the court affirm the defendant's convictions. Thank you.
And we're going to give your extra minute to you. You used your time, Mr. Weidenheimer, but take a minute.
Well, I'd briefly like to return to an issue that counsel was just discussing, which is the enhanced penalty for this section. Now, many of the courts that have discussed this issue have said it makes no sense because Congress intended to protect minors with this statute. It makes no sense to read a mens rea requirement as to age into the statute. It would undermine the statute's purpose. But again, there's a 3-to-1 ratio in terms of penalty for the minor crime versus the adult victim crime, which itself enacts the statute's purpose of protecting minors. So regardless of whether there's a mens rea requirement as to age, the statute does achieve its broad purpose of protecting minors.
But you would undermine it a bit. I mean, you're sort of saying they offset to some degree, and I'm not sure that we have any evidence that that's what Congress wanted them to do.
I agree, Your Honor, but I guess the issue is that we don't have any evidence one way or the other, and it certainly isn't clear enough a purpose to override the plain language of the statute. And in a situation where courts and the government is relying on a very broad statement of purpose, something as broad as protecting minors, there's very little for us to go on, which is exactly why we should be focusing on the plain language of the statute rather than broad precepts of statutory purpose. One final point I'd like to make, returning to the first issue about the bad acts evidence, I see the light has me, so...
Go ahead.
Which is that the government just argued that the fact that the government in closing arguments didn't really make a big issue of the fraud evidence, they say actually reduces the prejudice to the defendant. But in fact, there was so much evidence hanging out there, and the jury had no guidance from the government or the judge as to how to handle that. That's the classic instance where the jury is free to form propensity conclusions in their head and say, this is a person who commits fraud, he victimizes people, and I'm going to vote against him when it comes down to the verdict because I think he's a bad person. So, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.